just before I start, convey apologies from business and labor and the community constituency of NetLag. Their principals couldn't make it dictate the direction. And then the last one is 15 years ago, we spoke about the key challenges facing the country. Number one on that list was unemployment. Number two was poverty. Number three was economic growth. Number three was inclusive decision-making processes. Number four was dealing with globalization. And a couple of others that were also raised. So within that context, if barely 4 months ago, somebody stood up and said, it's about time that government show business how to do business, people would have thought we are insane. Barely 4 months ago, if somebody were to stand up in a public podium and said, government must now buy shares in banks or in the financial sector, I think people would have laughed even louder. Barely 4 months ago, if somebody were to say governments are now buying or bailing out the financial sector because they're running out of money, I think people would walk away from that meeting thinking that they are attending a meeting of mad people. I think if you were to say to the United States that you'll be the first in the queue to rescue the financial sector and become shareholders in banks, I don't know what would have happened if you had said that 4 months ago. But the harsh reality today is it's not considered ludicrous for government to become involved in business in a crudest form, by basically becoming shareholders. We read in the newspapers barely a week ago that Barclays, which is the major shareholder in Absa, is having difficulties. Some economic commentators were arguing that should the British government intervene to bail out Barclays, it would mean that Absa's shareholding or Absa ownership would basically be transferred to the British government. The British government would basically be the major shareholder in Absa, the owner of Absa, if you like. And then the question was, how would South Africans who are clients of Absa feel about that, being part of a bank that is owned by a foreign government? Now, these are the things that none of us thought they would ever happen, at least in our lifetime. But we are today sitting with that huge shift in terms of the landscape. And South Africa is by no way immune to some of the things that are happening globally, and I'll touch on that as we move along. Going back to those anecdotes, perhaps the notion that government has no business in business needs to be revisited. Perhaps the notion that the role of government is only that of creating an environment for business to prosper, perhaps it needs to be re-examined at some point. And the business of business being just business, it's also a notion that we need to look at. And as NetLag, at some point, these issues are going to surface. These issues are going to form very much part of the discussions in the organization. The year 2007-2008 has been an interesting year for us in terms of our vision, which I'm not going to go through line by line. The issue of unemployment in this country has not disappeared. The challenge is still very much with us, and it's becoming complex day by day in terms of what is it that we need to do in order to, at the very least, deal with the impact of so many people in our economy that are unemployed. The US is on an emergency mode. G20 particularly with unemployment that is threatening to hit 6 or 7%. It's a crisis in America when unemployment is in the region of 6 to 7%. We're talking double digits in South Africa, unemployment. So that should tell you how much deep the problem we have, or how much deep the challenge we have with respect to unemployment. And this calls for, in our view, partnerships, because there is no way that government alone could be able to address this problem. And it also calls on us to seriously identify the urgent challenges, in as much as everything is urgent, but there will be those things that perhaps we need to look at. And in our attitude as social partners in NEDLAC is selecting from many possible interventions those which hold the promise of the greatest possible impact and in the shortest possible time. So I think that philosophy will continue to underpin our work and the ways we do, we carry out our mandate or we execute our mandate at the institution. And we also believe that we need to secure commitment and active participation of all constituencies in those areas that have been identified for prioritized action in ways that build on lessons learned from development programs. This is NEDLAC. So people say that NEDLAC is not living up to its expectation or its mandate. I think in the main we are making a reference to these ladies and gentlemen. Some of the faces will be a bit older. The landscape has changed quite drastically in some areas. So the notable changes when we report for the next period, there will be, I think, the picture of Minister Didiza, or former Minister Didiza, will be replaced by Minister Deutsch. And also there will be other changes, as it were. But for the period under review, these were the principles that were overseeing the function of the institution. The structure, it's a very simple one. At the top, we have the National Summit, which is convened by the President of the Republic of South Africa. We just had one in December last year, and it was chaired by the President of the Republic of South Africa, Honorable Halima Motlanthe. And immediately below the National Summit, we have the Executive Council. It's made up of 72 members, equal representation from business, labor, community, and government. And the core ministers that serve on the Executive Council of NEDLAC are the Minister of Public Works, the Minister of Trade and Industry, the Minister of Finance, and the Minister of Labor, who also doubles up as the overall coordinator of government in NEDLAC. Then we have the Management Committee, whose function is to oversee the operations of the institution. If NEDLAC was a corporate institution, this would be our EXCO, the Executive Committee. And then we have chambers. That's where the real work happens. That's where the actual social dialogue takes place. The actual dialogue takes place in the four chambers of NEDLAC: the Development Chamber, Trade and Industry, Public Finance and Monetary Policy Chamber, and the Labor Market Chamber. And constituencies in NEDLAC are made up of business, and the voice of business in NEDLAC is Business Unity South Africa, and its president is Brian Malefe, the CEO of the PIC. And we have three federations from labor that makes up the voice of labor in NEDLAC: the Congress of South African Trade Unions, the National Council of Trade Unions, and producers. And for the community constituency, we have coalitions, the six coalitions that represent the voice of community-based organizations. Women, youth, SAMCO, Youth Council, Disabled People of South Africa, the cooperatives coalition, and the financial sector based coalition. That will be NEDLAC. In terms of our delivery instruments, we have the Trade and Industry Chamber. And in the Trade and Industry Chamber, we have six labor reps, six government representatives, and six lead government department in the Trade and Industry Chamber is the Trade and Industry, or the Department of Trade and Industry. Its role mainly is to deal with policy around trade, policy around industrial development, and policy with respect to investment in South Africa. So all the policies relating to trade, industrial development, and investment are dealt with in NEDLAC, almost without any exception. There are challenges in that area, as we will see later on in terms of trade. The Doha round at some point was said was in the ICU. At some point they said it's been declared partially dead, but it was resuscitated towards the end of the year with efforts to convene at some point a mini-ministerial meeting of the WTO to see if we cannot bring the Doha round back to life. One of the critical committees in WTO was the non-agricultural market access. They call it NAMA. Sounds like Nyama in Sinti. And it had a new chair. The old chair was not as sympathetic to South Africa, was not too sympathetic to South Africa. As a result, we couldn't get our way in there. But the new chair showed a bit of sympathy with the position that was advanced by South Africa. And NEDLAC took a view that perhaps what we need to do is to have a chat with the chair, the new chair, and see if we cannot strengthen his hand in terms of bringing in the developmental aspect of the Doha round, as it were. We are advised that the text, the chair's text on in WTO is the text that we can live with as South Africa, but that has not been confirmed, and there are processes to try and confirm that. So it's been quite interesting here in the Trade and Industry Chamber, and it's the busiest chamber in NEDLAC. There are challenges as well that we're going to talk to a bit later. and then we have the Labour Market Chamber, which deals basically with all labour market policies. All the labour market policies in South Africa are developed in this chamber of NEDLAC, without any exception. This is one chamber where there are no exceptions whatsoever. Every single policy that is proposed by the Department of Labour comes to NEDLAC, and we don't have to beg the Minister of Labour to bring those issues. He knows, it's his second culture to bring these issues. So he has become our ambassador as the institution in terms of also persuading other departments in government to see the value of bringing issues to NEDLAC. So this is, if the Employment Equity Act is a problem, NEDLAC is partly to blame for that. If the Labour Relations Act or the Labour Legislative Framework in South Africa is a problem, NEDLAC is very much part of that, or very much to blame for that in that case. Now, what we take comfort from the fact that all of these policies were NEDLAC agreements. They were NEDLAC deals where all the constituencies were present. So I would actually find it very strange if Labour were to then stand up outside of NEDLAC and complain about the Labour Legislative Framework in South Africa or the labour market policies in South Africa, when in actual fact they were part of developing them. They were part of the they were the architectures of these labour market policies. I would equally find it very strange for business to stand up and start making pot shots at the labour market policies in South Africa, because they were very much part of the deal. So standing up outside of the NEDLAC processes and complaining about the labour market policies, I find it very strange. It's something that I don't understand. But of course, particularly from business, they will argue that the landscape has changed and therefore there are no policies that should be monolithic. We need from time to time to review and bring our policies in line with the political landscape, the economic landscape, the social landscape, and so on. An argument which of course is very persuasive. But to take a general pot shot at labor market policies, I'll find it very strange. I think similarly, I'll find it very hard to accept that within government you would find certain government departments standing up publicly and taking pot shots at the labor market policies when government was very much part of the process to develop these policies. It's pretty hard. Bottom line is that all the labor market policies in this country were developed in Netherlands with all the social partners involved, and all of them represent a deal. And in the labor market policies, one thing that is unique is that we reach consensus on everything. NEDLAC has never brought something before Parliament and said, these are the areas of agreement on labor market policies and these are the areas of disagreement. There is just no room for areas of disagreement on the labor market policies. And we have never in our history tabled something that said areas of agreement and areas of disagreement. Not that we don't disagree, parties do disagree, but they find ways of how to construct something that all the parties can live with. Then at the bottom end, you may not be able to see the text, is the Public Finance and Monetary Policy Chamber. A difficult chamber. This is a chamber that deals with fiscal and monetary policy in the main. Ideally, before the budget is tabled in NEDLAC or in Parliament, or before the medium-term policy statement is made in Parliament, this chamber would have had a chance at some point to engage with what should actually be the main considerations for the medium-term and for the budget. It doesn't always happen that way, and it's a very tricky chamber in that the issues in that chamber are issues that require extreme care. You could imagine if just days before the budget, some people know already what's going to be in the budget. We might wake up the next day with the economy boiling or the economy having collapsed. So it requires extreme care in terms of how we deal with such issues. So that is understandable. But of course, developing a broad framework around what would be the desirable elements that should inform or underpin the budget ultimately, those are the kinds of issues that we deal with. For an example, in the business constituency in NEDLAC, there are people whose full-time occupation is premised on the information on how the budget is going to look like. Now imagine if these people were to get, first-hand or an insight into some of the stuff that goes into fiscal policy, the details of that before anybody else could know. Our stock exchanges will collapse the next day or almost immediately. So this requires extreme care. So it explains also why this is not the kind of chamber that will churn out deals or agreements every now and again. So the agreements there are few and far apart in the public finance and monetary policy. Then there's a monetary policy aspect that the chamber deals with, which is, of course, an exclusive preserve of the central bank in the main. So in the main, our monetary policy is managed by our central bank, and it's a tricky issue in the sense that the mandate for the bank is developed by government, but how to manage that mandate is a sole preserve of the central bank. Now, our central banker is an ex-officio member of the NEDLAC Executive Council. And the Minister of Finance is the sitting member, is a member of the Executive Council. I don't remember once, Mkalipi, when both of them were in one Executive Council meeting. I couldn't understand why, but I do now, that every time we have a problem with certain aspects of the monetary policy, if the Minister of Finance is present in the Executive Council, he will say, hey, the bank is independent. I can't interfere with those issues. So that will end the discussion. when we meet with the banker, of course the Minister of Finance will not be there. We'll say, well, we have a problem with the way you are executing your mandate. He will say, hey, I'm merely executing a mandate from government. You're talking to the wrong person. If you have a problem with this mandate, speak to the government. And the minister would conveniently not be there. So that will sort of also sort of shut the debates on those issues. So they are difficult issues because of the construct of the management of fiscal and monetary policy. Then we have the development chamber. Now the development chamber is meant to be the most powerful chamber in Nedbank, but unfortunately, it's not. It's nowhere near that. It's the chamber that needs to sit in the council and look at every policy that comes out of all other chambers to see if it meets the development imperatives in this country, the developmental agenda in this country. So they need to have a test that vets all the policies that come out of the other chamber. They need to take labor market policies and say, to what extent are the labor market policies that are coming out of the labor market chamber helping us to advance the developmental agenda? If they find problems with it, they need to identify those problems and come up with positions in terms of how we deal with that. They need to sit back in the development chamber and say, to what extent is our trade, industrial development, and investment policy, to what extent are they helping us to achieve some of the key objectives in our developmental agenda? And in that way, if they find problems, they must alert the Executive Council that they are problems. Similarly, with fiscal and monetary policy, that this chamber is meant to do that. So this is a chamber that has a veto that is not written anywhere. It's a veto that is there, but it's not written anywhere. It's a question of seizing the moment, seizing the opportunity, not beginning to play that role. So it is for that reason that I argue all the time that this is the most powerful chamber in Nedbank, despite the fact that it does not sit in the trade and industry chamber. It also, community does not sit in the labor market chamber. Community also does not serve in the public finance and monetary policy chamber. But they serve in subcommittees of those chambers. So despite the fact that they are not there, by virtue of them being in the executive council, having the same number of seats as everybody else, and the executive council being the place where all the Nedbank outcomes, the Nedbank reports are finally ratified, that presents an excellent opportunity for the community constituency in this chamber to make sure that the policies coming out of Nedbank are policies that are not out of sync with the broader developmental agenda. But that's not the case. That's a sad part. It's not the case. We haven't really maximized the value that the development chamber could play. And the reasons are, one reason that is very simple is that until such time that community-based organizations take ownership of that chamber, they provide leadership in that chamber, the other constituencies are unlikely to come to the party because they have other areas where they could deal with their issues. So business can quite happily deal with whatever issues that are developmental in the labor market, trade and industry, and public finance. Similarly, labor can quite usefully help use the labor market chamber, trade and industry chamber, and public finance and monetary policy chamber to drive their agenda. But community don't have that luxury as things stand right now. The only platform they have is the development chamber. But you don't see that sense of agency and that sense that that's the only place where they could influence policy in Nedbank or in the country. If you look at how actively they are driving the agenda, as it were. At best, I mean, they get sucked into other constituencies' agendas. So if we fix the community constituency, chances are that would automatically fix the development chamber. We're getting there. We're not desperate. We are not calling May Day yet. Not May Day as in the Workers' Day, but made there is in the crisis. We think the chamber is on the right path. It's just a question of fine-tuning certain things. Then the last delivery instrument for NEDLAC is the standing committees. We have one on Section 77, a standing committee that looks at issues relating to socio-economic protest action. It's an instrument that gives effect to the constitutional right of workers to protest, but which brings in the second element, which is equally important, and it's an element of protecting workers when or should they embark on protest action, protecting them from being dismissed and so on, which is a provision of the Labor Relations Act. So Section 77, Standing Committee in NEDLAC, gives effect to that protection, as it were. And then the second one is the Standing Committee on Demarcations. In events where there are disputes in industries, we also have a Standing Committee that helps in terms of defining the various sectors and which sectors belong to which bargaining councils and so on. Then we have a Standing Committee that we call TESELICO. It's a technical sectoral committee that deals with trade policy. Nothing else but trade policy. So all the trade policies that the Minister of Trade and Industry from time to time announces are policies that are developed in that standing committee of NEDLAC. How we deal with multilateral and bilateral trade negotiations are also issues that are dealt with in that standing committee. So that's our delivery instrument, as it were. The one point that I want to make before I move off this slide is there is often confusion out there that NEDLAC is also responsible for the implementation of the policies that we develop. That is far from the truth. We are not an implementing agency. We are not the instrument that implements policy. Our job is influencing policy, shaping policy. And then once the policy is shaped, we then hand it over to an appropriate institution. If there isn't an existing institution to implement, we create new ones. We've created quite a number of them in the 14 years that we've been around, and most of them in the labor market environment, quite a number of them. But we hand over a policy to an institution to implement. Some of them are in the trade environment, like the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal. We set up that agency to implement the competition policy. And we've set up quite a number of those institutions. We call them the NEDLAC family, as it were. So we don't implement policy. But if the policy doesn't work, fingers must be pointed at NEDLAC, if there's justification for that. So if policy is not working purely because of administrative problems, then that should not be an issue that is thrown at NEDLAC. That should be an issue that is thrown to an agency or an institution that is charged with the responsibility of implementing policy. So if CCMA is a problem and it's found that, look, the problem in CCMA is merely administrative, we should not then attack CCMA as an institution or the Labor Relations Act or the decision to establish the CMA as an issue. We must focus our energy on what is the problem at hand. I'm going to now rush this because we've done this a couple of times. Our mandate can be summed up in 5 points. We strive to promote the goals of economic growth, participation in economic making, and social equity. We seek to reach consensus and conclude agreements pertaining to social and economic policy. We consider all significant changes to social and economic policy. We encourage and promote the formulation of coordinate policy. And we are also involved in socio-economic dispute resolution. And this must not be confused with the role of CCMA. CCMA deals with workplace bargaining, workplace-related type disputes. We deal with socio-economic disputes. There's a very fine line between the two. I mean, a classical example is a Section 77 that was filed by the Motor Workers Transport Union. They were protesting against the cash and transit robberies. And in their demands, on some of the issues they were raising was that they don't carry appropriate calibered firearms. That was the first one. The second one was they are not getting training, appropriate training, as people who drive these vans. The third one was these vans had no working air conditions. Because you see these cash vans there, they don't have windows. So you actually are in the oven, in the, mm-hmm. the driver, unless an air condition works. So the air condition has to work. And wherever they park these cars, they're not switched off, they're idling, which just exacerbates the heat that develops in the car. And the third reason was that during one robbery in Johannesburg, a child was killed while on the back of the mother. The standing committee in which Mkhalipi also serves, we said the first demand is wrong place. It doesn't belong in a Section 77, it belongs in the workplace, and therefore NEDLAC is the wrong institution to deal with. That was the one about wrong calibered rifles that they carry, firearms. The second one was about lack of training. We said that one also does not belong to NEDLAC or socioeconomic disputes. It belongs elsewhere, therefore we can't deal with it. The third one was about vans that had no air conditioning. We said that one also doesn't belong to NEDLAC, it belongs in the workplace. There was only one that we said belonged to Section 77. That was the one where the baby, where the society is getting caught in the crossfire of a business activity. So it's only that one that we're prepared to look at. So that you can see there's a very fine line in terms of what is socioeconomic and what is not, as it were. So that was just by example in terms of some distinction that we make so that people are not just allowed to protest on issues that have a platform where they could be dealt with more appropriately. We negotiate. The tools we use, we negotiate, we consult, we do information sharing, we do research, and of course we deal with socioeconomic disputes. There are times when the government department will come to NEDLAC and say, we're merely bringing in this policy for consultation, period. In the process of doing that, constituents say, no, this must be for consultation and negotiation. So it varies from time to time. Process in NEDLAC is that government would normally table its program of policy and legislation in NEDLAC at the beginning of the year, around March, because what normally happens in government, roughly, is that the ruling party will go to its Yakutla in December, and then January it will be a cabinet Yakutla, then there will be a State of the Nation address, and then lastly there will be the budget speech, and then Parliament will finalize the program. And that's the program that is often tabled in NEDLAC. We cherry-pick in NEDLAC on what policies we would like to deal with. Sometimes the cherry-picking is not done properly, and we miss certain policies, and we only pick up way down the road that we should have actually identified a particular policy for discussion. And I'm not going to go through the rest, but that's the process. And there are instances where we seek an intervention of a relevant minister. If the officials at the level of the negotiations can't reach agreement, then we bring in the minister and see if we can find a way to deal with some of the issues that may arise, as it were. Parties are bound not to reopen discussions in Parliament on any issue where agreement was reached in NEDLAC. Now, this is difficult to police, because what happens between Pretoria and Cape Town is anybody's guess. There are instances where the policy will change or the network agreement will change whilst on the route from Pretoria to Cape Town. So it's an issue that is hard to police, but it's an issue that we make every effort to ensure that what appears in Parliament before a relevant portfolio committee is the same as what was agreed in NEDLAC. Of course, we still get the privilege of being called by portfolio committees in Parliament to come and present the network agreement on an issue. But we still battle to get into other portfolio committees. It's an issue that we're looking at, and there are proposals on how to deal with it going forward. This is a bit of bragging, which I'm not going to do, with your permission. Now, coming back to the things we said we were going to do and what is it that we have done, there's an issue that has been here for the last 4 years, and it's an issue that is closer to members of this committee. And that's an issue of the changing nature of work and the atypical forms of employment, casualization. Now, one thing that we need to appreciate is that this is an issue that not all parties will come and engage with the same level of enthusiasm. Because in this issue, we're talking about how to deal with the workers who, by default, have fallen outside of the Labor Relations Act net, protection net, that is. It's also, casualization is also defined as vulnerable workers. Now, the attitude from the Department of Labor, at least the minister, is that if we still have workers who fall outside of the protection ambit of the labor law, then the labor law is not doing its function. Then we need to do something about it. And the minister's take on the issue is very clear, is that what you do is that you find ways of how to bring those workers who are outside of the net in the net. That is done on the matter. On the other hand, other constituencies are saying, but hey, casualization has become a global phenomenon. It's the way of doing business. So you can't, as South Africa, begin to say, well, away with casualization when it has actually become the way of doing business globally, not only in South Africa. So you could then appreciate the polemics and the tensions and the different points of departure of the social partners in NEDLAC as a reason why, I mean, after 4 years of trying to grapple with this issue, we still haven't found one another. But there's an opportunity that has been created for all of us, and the opportunity arose in the ILO. The ILO has now adopted a policy framework, and it's called decent work. It's called decent work. If you remember in 1994, towards the end of 94, immediately after the elections in 1995, the word globalization became en vogue. It became like part of every speech. You won't sit with economists for 5 minutes without the word globalization popping up every now and again. Now, the word decent work has assumed that space at the moment. It pops up everywhere. And one anecdotal comment is that even the ANC's manifesto talks about decent work. Then you could see it's permeating almost everything that we're doing. Everybody, decent work is the thing. It's the thing these days. So that has given us a lifeline in that in the ILO, where also businesses represented internationally, they adopted this policy of decent work. All what it means is that one is respect for core labor standards, labor rights, collective bargaining, and so on. It also has as one of its strategic objectives social security as a second aspect in there. The third aspect that it has in there is also that of social dialogue, that there has to be social dialogue in the countries. Member countries must have social dialogue institutions or ways of how to engage as social partners. Child labor touches on some of those issues. So, and then, of course, it talks about decent work as in employment that has social security, the benefits accruing to all the workers. So this presents an opportunity for us, a platform for us, to build onto an international agreement or an international accord on what decent work is, to bring in the aspect of the changing nature of work and their typical forms of employment. So we tried to deal with it as a country. We had difficulties. Now we're going to deal with it within the context of the international code of good practice, and in this particular case, being the decent work policy framework that was adopted by the ILO. So it's underway. Those discussions are underway. There is pressure from the Department of Labor for us to finalize this issue. As early as Thursday last week, the acting DG from the Department of Labor called on all the network social partners to move with some speed in terms of finalizing this matter. So it's underway, and we hope that we'll be able to crack this issue. You are going to be asked when you go to your constituencies that what have you done about casualization, because it is indeed a problem. Bear with us. We are not going to be able to give you better ammunition to respond to that question other than the process. It's a process, and it requires us to take it up. And it's pleasing, of course, to see that also in the different political manifestos, the concept of decent work is beginning to permeate some of the promises or some of the things that political parties are planning to do going forward, which will then shape policy. Skills Development Amendment Act, we dealt with that.
Before that, casualization. I this committee doesn't want to hear a thing about that. Now, when you say it's a way of doing business, can you explain more about it?
Well, it's not me, Madam Chair, saying that, but it's one of the network constituencies who are saying that. But I can share with you some of the arguments that these constituencies, which at the moment I'm not going to divulge, that this constituency is the one that is arguing this position, as it were. But the one argument is that generally business has cycles. They have peaks and valleys. There are times when the business will require more workers, and there are times when they would not require workers. Now, if you factor the cost of doing business into the equation, then it doesn't make sense that when the business is at its peak, it needs 100 workers, but when it's at its lowest level, it needs 50, you still continue with 100. They say casualization then is the instrument that helps this flexibility that people are only called in at times of need. That's the one argument. The one example that is made is in shopping malls. That these days you can wake up at 8 o'clock in the evening on Sunday, jump into your car, drive to a mall, you find a shop open. One or two shops open. You can do shopping at 8 o'clock in the evening on Sunday. And that is, in a sense, they're saying the society to a certain extent is to blame for this. Because the business is merely responding to a societal need. So if you wake up at 8 in the evening and go to a shopping mall, it means there is need. So business is there to meet a need. So if it has to meet that need, there is no permanent worker who would want to be at work at 8 p.m. on Sunday. So what are we saying? Are we saying that the shop must close, and therefore you wake up at 8 p.m. on Sunday, you go to a mall, you don't find what you want? Are you going to be a pleased customer? So it's complex. I mean, when they start advancing these arguments, you begin to see that, oh, my God, I didn't think of that angle. I didn't think of that. But those are some of the arguments that are being raised. The other constituency then argues that, well, fine, we see the need, but why are these workers not part of the social benefits that accrue to other workers? Why are they not entitled to have medical aid like other workers? The unions are even complaining that, look, they can't get those workers to join unions because they can never have those workers in a meeting because they seem to be working all the time. Then the other concept, well, it's not us who causes them to work all the time. We are addressing the need. There's a need out there. Now, as business, we survive on opportunities. There's a need. We're serving a need. We need people to serve the need. So there's an argument for casualization, which in a sense I can safely say that there's no one who has come up with a convincing argument that shoots down that argument that there's a need that is being addressed. The gripe or the trouble with casualization.
Are you justifying the song or scene? When it came in of a system that can be amended, but must be destroyed.
Okay, can I finish? Can I finish, Honorable Member? The trouble with casualization is not so much about casualization. It is more about casualization not segmenting workers into two groups, dividing workers into two types of workers. There's even a view that says if casuals were to get all the benefits that permanent workers get, casualization would cease to be an issue. If they will get all the protection that is in the law, it doesn't become an issue. The trouble with casualization is that they are excluded from the protection of the law, they don't enjoy the same benefits as permanent workers, that's an issue. So if we address those issues, casualization becomes just a term that might be meaningless, as it were. So the trouble is benefits and protection, as it were. So the jury still asks, Honourable Member, in terms of whether or not the system can be changed, but the Minister of Labour is arguing, it's very firm, that casual workers must be inside the tent, if one were to use that metaphor, as opposed to the current situation where they are outside of the tent. And he argues that until such time that the current labour legislative framework addresses that problem, then it's not worth the paper it's written on, because it talks about protecting workers in general and vulnerable workers in particular. So if it doesn't achieve that objective, then our, you know, world-renowned labour legislative or labour relations act has still not done what it was meant to do. Now, I don't know whether the NEDLAC engagements are going to emerge with a deal on this matter. But the first phase indicates that there is commitment to address the issue. The question is, how do we then find a construct that does not, or a construct that is a delicate balance between the need and the way casualization is happening and between the reality and the ideal. So we need that delicate balance, as it were, going forward. So, Madam Chair, it's a difficult one, this one. But I'm pleased that at the very least, as I said earlier on, that the concept decent work is beginning to permeate our lives. I was listening to SAFM last night, and one of the debates with some gurus in labor law were about decent work. What is this decent work? How does it put a spanner in the works? I mean, I've heard parties who are currently in parliament talking about decent work. Some talk about decent work in a negative sense, but the fact that they are at least discussing it, I think it's a major achievement for all of us, that at least it's on the agenda. People are discussing it. Whether they discuss it in a negative sense or positive sense, I think that's another matter. So I think first part of the battle is won for the workers, Honourable Member. I think the other issues I'm not going to dwell too much on. In terms of the skills development, excellent piece of work there. It's in Parliament, and I think it's signed off already. We're already setting up the institutions now to give effect to the latest amendment to the skills development. Corporate law reforms, we concluded the NEDLAC processes, and I think there are difficulties with that law, but they're not with NEDLAC now. NEDLAC has done its part, but there are difficulties elsewhere, which still require some attention going forward. World trade organizations, the WTO stalemate is still far from being resolved. We're staying close to that process, as it were. The National Technical Regulatory Framework, we concluded the NEDLAC processes on that. On social plan review, we concluded the review. What we're dealing with now is the recommendations, is to deal with the recommendations that the review has thrown up. And the social plan review become even more critical now, given the global economic crisis or the global financial crisis and the impact that it's having on our economy as South Africa. So social plan would be an instrument that would require urgent attention from all social partners. So it's an issue that was raised on Thursday last week at the Management Committee of NEDLAC. That is an issue that we need to take up. It was also raised in the process that flowed out of the Presidential Economic Working Group that seeks to develop a view on how we deal with these issues. If I skip a point, Madam Chair, that people want to dive on, please let me know. I'm just going to scroll through so that we have a bit of time in that aspect. The expanded public works program, it's been extended. I think government has extended it for another period. And we're now in the process of identifying areas that work well and to find ways of how to craft new strategies around those issues. It also comes in when we deal with South Africa's rescue package to the global economic crisis. It does come in the question of expanded public works. I'll talk to it a bit later when I deal with that aspect. The DFIs, we're saying they need to align their mandate so that at the very least we are able to use the capacity in the development and finance institutions to help deal with some of the key challenges facing the country. Decent Country Work Program, it's an issue. We finalized phase one. Phase one was merely to develop the framework for South Africa. So that framework has been developed. What we need to do now is to develop various strategies that take some of the six key strategic objectives of the Decent Work Program for South Africa. And we've already tabled our first draft framework in the ILO, and now what's required is for us to start developing strategies of how to achieve a comprehensive social security in South Africa and how to ensure that there's job creation in South Africa, and not just any job, a decent job in South Africa, which at the moment casualization does not fall within that category. So the Decent Work Country Program is going to help in terms of defining what is this decent work, as it were, what are the key elements of it. We, as you know, last year we had an energy or electricity crisis, load shedding and outages. As NEDLAC, we were called to find a way of how to address it. We sprung into action, both on the instruction from the presidency, that we need to find a way of how to deal with this issue. I'm happy to say that we had an excellent, firstly, framework agreement. We reached an excellent framework agreement on how to find the balance between the economic and social dimension of electricity and going forward. And we had an excellent stakeholder summit that looked at bringing everybody else into the loop, getting a buy-in from the broader society into this. But what was more interesting for me in hindsight was that despite all the hullabaloo around energy, electricity crisis, including the outcome of the National Stakeholder Summit on conference on electricity, NESA still behaved independently. So we told them what to do, what we would like them to do, but they still did something that was not exactly what we wanted them to do, but it was close. So there was some noise, but not much noise, because NESA did something that was close to what we wanted. So that demonstrated that they're still independent, they still looked at the issues, despite the National Summit, which was quite huge, which could have easily intimidated them to do what we wanted. They still did what they thought was good for the country, and it was not entirely what we wanted, but it was quite close to what we wanted. Excellent achievement, in my view. Anti-poverty, a strategy that is driven in the Deputy President, by the Deputy President. We do have a framework now. We do have a draft policy proposition. We're looking at developing or concluding a framework for South Africa on how to deal with poverty. But we've been overtaken by events. If you look at the economic global crisis, it just overtakes that stuff. It says to us, if you do not already have a response to poverty, then it's not, you've got no chance of surviving going forward. So this has been put on the fast lane. It's an issue that we're looking at. HIV and AIDS is an issue that also we're dealing with, and we're dealing very much here with the National Strategy Plan, which has brought together all the social partners. And as NETLAC, we chose a couple of areas that we think we can do, and we think we can do best, and we're driving those issues. Public transport, we had a meeting with the senior leadership in the Department of Transport, including the minister, to look at the way forward in terms of putting in place public transport, credible public transport strategies and the implementation, the rollout plan of the public transport. I think in some of the provinces, already this rapid rail bus service is on the verge of being launched, or it's on the verge of being operationalized. And of course, not everybody likes them, especially from the sector itself, the transport sector itself. But we see some progress in those areas. We also had a trade policy session with Deputy Minister Davis to look at how do we respond to the WTO stalemate, and how do we position South Africa on a number of issues, including the U.S. with the change of administration in the U.S. What's going to be the dynamics going forward? The economic partnership agreement with the EU, also an issue that we looked at, which is causing a lot of strife, as it were, especially on the EU side, and it has also threatened to divide the customs union. And in fact, it is divided in a sense, in that some members of the customs union signed the revised EFTA. I think South Africa and Namibia are just about the only two countries that didn't sign, and it's putting a lot of pressure on the two countries to come to the party. And in fact, we are branded by Europe as spoilers, which is quite difficult. And other member states of SACU are also sort of seeing us as delaying their prosperity in terms of economic growth and so on by stalling those negotiations. We've done the CETA review, but the CETA review that we did was merely to look at the functioning and management of the various CETAs. And we did this at the time when CETAs were under extreme pressure, as some of the CETAs were just not living up to their expectations. So we did this, and this surfaced some of the issues that we need to pay attention to. And of course, because CETAs are run by boards, we're not going to jump in there as NETLAC for corporate governance purposes. We are not allowed to do that, or we're not permitted to do that. But what's going to happen is that the NETLAC social partners will then brief their representatives who sit on CETA boards to take forward some of the recommendations that have emerged out of our review. And it will also inform the National Industrial Policy Framework in terms of where that is going. Then the last point in terms of key output is the South Africa's response to the global financial and or economic crisis. The President summoned all the NETLAC social partners together with the big business working group to the union buildings on the 4th of December 2008. On the agenda was, how do we respond, in addition to various scenarios for South Africa, how do South Africa respond to this crisis? Then we were given an instruction to go as NETLAC and working with the presidency to go and develop a South Africa's response to the global economic crisis. We've had three meetings so far. We've had the first draft of what we think should be South Africa's response to the global economic crisis. And decent work popped up everywhere in that draft. It's a draft that has been signed off by the negotiators. Just let me repeat this. This is a draft that has been provisionally signed off by the drafter, the trustee. It hasn't been signed off by the principal. So in the case of government, they need to take it back to their principals for mandating and sign-off. For labor, they must take it back to their principals for mandating and sign-off. Business needs to do likewise. Community needs to do likewise. So it's a document that is still very much, I'm still very much sitting on it, because it's a document that does not represent a formal stamp of the NetLife Social Partners. But the drafters in NetLife, after hours of negotiation, said this is what we can take to our principals. So we have a sense of how we need to respond to this. And this is where pops up everywhere. I got a very funny SMS recently after the document went out to principals. The SMS says, well, it looks like we have rehashed the ANC election manifesto. And it was anonymous, but I could respond to it. I replied, I said, well, which part of this draft do you think is a rehash or mirrors the ANC manifesto? I think your guess is correct. There's a decent word. There's decent work in this stuff everywhere. It pops up everywhere. That's the ANC election manifesto, as it were. I don't know where it came from. It was anonymous. But this thing of decent work, this decent work thing is an in thing, and there's no way you're gonna duck it. I mean, it's like dodging raindrops on a rainy day. It's just there, in your face. So it's in there. There was a bit of screaming and kicking when it first emerged in our drafting stuff. But when we started analyzing it, unpacking what it is everything that is in our Labor Relations Act, in our labor policy, labor market policy. It's everything in there. In the decent work, there's nothing in decent work that you can stand up publicly and attack. And you think you can get away, with it. Decent work is a collective noun for what this society has said we are about. It's captured in decent work. So you can't stand up and attack it. And I think the ANC has not done us a favor by including decent work in its manifesto.
Okay, point of order. On a point of order, can I just ask you to maybe keep the presenter to the presentation so we can finish that and then we can enter into debate and discussion, perhaps comments. I'm getting the feeling that the presentation has developed into a kind of a discussion or on merits or demerits of certain issues.
Okay. And when we are through with this, especially your output, maybe going back to the fisheries policy.
Okay.
I think if Mrs. Moss was here, would really want to know about these balance between commercial and subsistence fishing in South Africa.
Thanks, Andrew Chair. So the sum total is that the draft, the first draft, is gone out to principals for them to mandate whether or not this is some of the stuff they will agree to. And until that happens, the draft is not for public consumption unless it is through a constituency. So to get sight of this, if you are government, I think your best chance is to stay close to government. You might get an insight into this. If you are business, it could be useful to stay close to business. You might get an insight. If you're part of the labor constituency, you might get an insight on a draft, as it were, in terms of where this is going. But we hope this is the draft. Once it's been signed off by the principal, we will have to take it back to the president and say, this is what you said. You said we must go and do some work. This is what we have produced in terms of the South Africa's response on the issue. SADC and IPA, I think I've touched on that. I'm not going to go through that again. Industrial Policy Action Plan, we've concluded our discussions on this matter. It's a matter now that sits in the Department of Trade and Industry with a view of giving it a bit of wind so that it starts flying. There are a number of issues that needs to come in there, including budgetary requirements for this policy to take off, and those are the issues that have been driven by the Department of Trade and Industry. You will recall that the Minister of Finance, in one of his budget speeches, I think it was 2008, introduced the notion of developing the national poverty line for South Africa. And indeed, he did table a proposal on this matter, and it was tabled in NEDLAC. And the view in NEDLAC is that you can't deal with national poverty line in isolation to the broader national poverty measures, as it were. So it's an issue that has gone back to the Department, National Treasury, and Social Development. They're working on a government house view on how this policy needs to look like. So it's an issue that we're looking at. Local implementation. This is an area where the attempt here is to see if we cannot develop social dialogue capacity at local level. So far, we've only managed to develop some capacity at provincial level. At local level has become a bit difficult so far. It's an area that we haven't addressed as yet, but it's an area that's on our radar screen. But at provincial level, we do have a couple of NEDLAC, so to speak, at provincial level. Northwest, Western Cape, KZN, we do have institutions that mirror what we're trying to do at national level. National Youth Development Policy Framework, we finalized the NEDLAC discussions on this issue. We had difficulties with it. But the tricky part on this was that this process was triggered by Parliament. So there's not much we could have done to change some of the things in here. But we did have a chance to deal with some of the issues in the National Youth Development Policy Framework, which also involves the question of merging Umsobomvu Youth Fund into a National Youth Development Fund or National Youth Development Agency. We dealt with those issues. Some degree of discomfort in some of the areas, but there was not much that we could do as NEDLAC. SMME promotion, this is an issue that is very much linked to provincial procurement policy. The president, the former president, in his State of the Nation address, did indicate that government was going to identify 10 products that will be ring-fenced for SMMEs. That process has gone some way. We have an idea as to what those 10 products are. But in order for that to happen, we need to amend the preferential procurement policy. That's the sticky point at the moment. That's an issue that is still outstanding in terms of amending the procurement policies, as it were. So we're looking at that issue. But the 10 products, in a sense, have been identified, and there's some degree of agreement on that. I'm going to go back to fisheries and then go to conclusion, Madam Chair, so that we can have time to engage. On the fisheries policy, the view was sparked off by quotas, the issuing of quotas, and more especially the fishing communities in the Western Cape. Had difficulties with how these quotas were administered. In some of the fishing communities in the Western Cape, that is almost their sole source of livelihood, is fishing. So if it is managed in the way that only looks at commercial interests, without looking at the subsistence aspect of it, the view of the social partners is that it's not going to do us any good. So what we're trying to do is to find this balance between not compromising the commercial needs, because also in the commercial dimension does bring in job opportunities, it does bring in all sorts of other things. But we said, look, there has to be that balance. That commercial must not be given priority over subsistence farming, because those communities literally depend on the fishing activities. So that's the kind of balance that we're trying to bring into the loop. And this is one area, as you remember, as you would recall, the Trade and Industry Chamber community does not serve in that chamber. But on this issue, community constituents have been invited to be part of the discussions on the issue because we understand the importance. Then, Chair, I'm going to go to conclusion. Then we can have some time for discussion because the other things are more operational and generic. Oh, the one thing, Chair, is that we had a clean audit for the period, and of course we are engaging with the department, given the cycles in terms of what other things we can do to get more money. But that's a matter that we're dealing with at the level of the executive. It's not a matter for this committee at this stage. But the spending patterns amongst the three key cost centers are administration is 20% of our grant, and our grant, of course, is 13 million. So 12 million for this period, 12.7 million for the year, and then for the current year is 13.3 million. And 20% of that goes to administration, 28% goes to employee costs, and 52% goes to what we are about. And we're very pleased with this picture, and we want to keep this picture longer in the sense that we are not using the money that we are given for other things, but the money is basically used for to take forward our mandate. Then some of the key challenges that I think might be important, Madam Chair, is improving relationship with government departments in order to enhance compliance with the network protocol. I said earlier on we still have difficulties with some government departments that do not actually appreciate the value that NetLex brings. But when they do come eventually, they see the value, and we don't battle to get them to come on board. I mean, last year we had to approach the office of the leader of government business in Parliament and the chief whip to seek an intervention because we were in trouble. Bills were in Parliament even before they were first tabled in NetLex. And that engagement was extremely successful in that now we're seeing more and more government departments wanting to come. And I think in terms of our conclusion is that we would seek, and this was one of the issues that came out of our engagement with the leader of government business, is that we must seek an engagement with Parliament with a view of incorporating how the relationship between NetLex and Parliament can be codified, possibly finding ways into the rules of the National Assembly or finding a way into the joint rules of Parliament. I mean, since we are an institution that is established through an Act of Parliament, we think it follows that we need to find better ways of how to regulate our relationship so that things don't fall off the track as we move forward. So NetLex seeks a commitment from all government departments to observe the negotiated NetLex protocol on tabling and consideration of issues in NetLex. And NetLex would like to thank Parliament in general and this committee in particular for a solid working relationship that has been developed over the years. And we wish you all the best in the forthcoming general election. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mkhize, but I thought you would maybe want to tell us about your financial performances while Mr. Dahl is here. I thought he would be there to maybe to clarify something. If he can just give us a hint on those on the statement.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you can see from the 2007 year, there was quite a minimal increase in 2008. It was roughly about 8%. What happened in 2008 is we actually we surpassed our budget that was actually given to us, and there are a number of reasons for that. We have quite a healthy balance sheet, and the number of activities that took place in 2008 was far greater than what was actually budgeted for. But because we had surpluses brought forward from prior years, and with the approval from National Treasury, we were actually allowed to utilize those funds from prior years to fund our projects that took place in that year, which resulted in us having a deficit for that year. But in prior years, we've always maintained a surplus. And as you know, National Treasury is always pleased if funds from prior years start getting utilized. So they were quite happy that for the first time, we started utilizing surpluses brought forth from prior years. That's basically it.
If I may just add one point, okay? You would recall that some of the constituencies, because we do allocate some funds for capacity of the constituencies, so some of the constituencies had actually accumulated their allocations non-utilized, and we then called on them to start utilizing those funds, or else they will forfeit. So one of the reasons, therefore, that we had a deficit is that constituencies started using their reserves to build capacity to be able to engage on some of the difficult issues that featured on the agenda for the year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a couple of comments and questions. I'll just go down the list. The first one is more comment than a question. It's on the relationship between business and government. And it's traditionally been the case, and I think probably international, that there's quite a cozy relationship between big business and government. It's a mutually kind of dependent relationship, and they co-depend on each other. So you'll find that big business, often would kind of try and find favor with the government of the day. It's been like that, you know, big business, if I can use the word, sucked up to the old National Party government, and now they are kind of trying to stay in the good books of the ANC, so nothing has changed there. But the problem is, with this cozy relationship, they're looking after each other's interests, but it's not necessarily in the interest of the workers, and especially aspiring workers, because big business doesn't employ more and more people. Deployment, new employment, intake of new workers happens at medium, small business level, and these people often are not represented at NEDLAC. I've talked to small and medium business people, and they say they are at a disadvantage. They don't have the capacity that big business has to nominate people, to pay people full-time, to sit on these committees, to participate in all these discussions. Big businesses, big corporations, they've got specialized legal departments and human resource departments where they have the people or can employ the people, the expert people to look after these matters. Small and medium-sized families and business, family businesses, for example, don't have that capacity, they don't have that luxury, so they fall out of the bus and their interests are not represented in the negotiations in NEDLAC. That's the first point. The other point I want to mark is about NEDLAC's relationship or attitude or approach to Parliament. I have an uneasy feeling about a number of comments that were made today. Let me talk about the one specific one on the process. Parties are bound not to reopen discussion in Parliament on any area where agreement was reached in NEDLAC. Now, obviously, that applies to government then, because the agreement is between government and business in NEDLAC. But that does not apply, and I want to stress that, to ordinary MPs. So any topic, can be and must be raised in Parliament and will be raised by ordinary members of Parliament. That's their job, and to hold government to account, and by implication then also NEDLAC, seeing that there's this cozy relationship. And, you know, so I just almost want to warn NEDLAC that, you know, this will happen. Anything will be discussed in Parliament, whether you like it or not. You also can't describe to NASA what, you know, what they should do, although you try to do, and I'm glad to hear that they've maintained the independence, they took into consideration.
consideration to an extent, but they maintain the independence. So that's a warning signal that I just want to sound here at this stage. Then the next point, Madam Chair, is on casualization. It came out very strongly, and in a way the presenter started debating it before we've opened it up for discussion. I got the impression from the comments made that decent work was put almost against or as opposed to casualization. You can have casual workers or you can have decent work, as if the two are opposing each other or contradicting each other. Now, I would think that all work, any work, is decent work. If you are doing a job, an honest day's work, and you get payment for it, that's decent work. You do your work and you get paid for it, and you earn a living in an honest way. There's nothing wrong with it. Even if it's a lowly paid job, or even if it's a job of low status, what is decent work? Is the cleaning lady, is her job, does she not earn a living in an honest way? Is that not a decent work? Can't she support her children and send the children to school by cleaning floors? I would think if that's an honest day's work, and if she's educating her children that way, that's decent work. Also want to say about casualization. I think casualization has happened and growing as a phenomenon because in reaction to the over-strict labor laws, the casualization is actually a phenomenon where people are now trying to get outside of the labor laws. This has happened in reaction to the strict labor laws. Because the first ladder of the first step of the ladder for people to get into the labor market and improve themselves and climb that ladder is often too high. They can't get their foot onto that first ladder. It's too high because they are unskilled and they uneducated and they can't get a job. Casualization is a way of getting around it, so they're lowering the first step of that ladder and helping people to get the foot onto the ladder. It's an opportunity for them to get into the labor market. And I would think any job is better than no job, or half a job is still better than no job at all. People are desperate. And besides, why are we trying to take away the right of people to decide for themselves? If you're unemployed, if you're desperate, if you're you're desperate to feed your children, if you're a mother, unemployed mother, and you enter into an agreement to do a certain job for a certain pay and you think you can help your children, prevent your children from starving, what's wrong with that? Or why should government try and persuade or prescribe to people you're not allowed to do this kind of job because it's casual and therefore not decent? I have a problem with that. I think we must think more about the unemployed, the desperate people who don't have this and not stop looking after the vested interests of those, but the people who are in jobs are well protected because of unions, because of labor regulations. That's fine. They're protected, and that's good. But we must also look after the people who are unemployed and desperate to find jobs and who find it difficult to get into the labor market because of a low level of skills. Madam Chair, last point, I just want to ask about progress regarding the task team appointed by President Motlanthe on weathering the economic storm. What progress has been made? And the report was supposed to be submitted in February. We're now just into February. But what progress has been made? When can we have that report?
Are you still?
I'm content.
Thank you, Chairperson, and Cheng, and thank you to Dr. Herbert for your presentation. I hope that there might be a need for the portfolio committee to recall the NEDLAC, because I think there's a lot of detail that might be required on some of the areas where they've concluded on these focus areas. I think there's been a lot of detail that we might need. But Jefferson, whilst I'm resisting to be tempted to get into the debate on decent work and casualization, I just think that my colleague, Mrs. Dreher, might have to do a little bit of work on understanding decent work. There are a lot of other factors and elements that make up decent work. You can't talk about that, not talking about fair hours, fair pay, safety, and all those kind of things. And if you just say it's about the work, if you you are a cleaner doesn't really talk to decent work. Decent work is much more about it. And if we're going to use the fact that the people are desperate for jobs and therefore there's nothing therefore wrong about deciding to go for casualization, I think it is problematic because it has got everything to do with denying people their right as workers. But I'm not going to get into that debate now because I'm just hoping that the debate that was scheduled for Parliament on creating decent work will come. And I think we can have an opportunity there as political parties to discuss that. The area on development chamber, where you were talking about the community constituencies not taking ownership of that chamber, which I believe has got to do with the capacity. I'm not sure what is the role of NEDLEC to try and assist those. I know that, for instance, that the community constituencies was, had serious problems in using the money that you've talked about now. But I don't know if you have a specific program to try and assist them to build that capacity. I can speak from the sector that I represent as well, but that represents me, which is the disability sector, that we had serious problems. One of the problems is that to even find the suitable people to represent us at NEDLEC. And what program is there that you can try and put in place to assist? I think you said you've concluded on public transport. If you could indicate to us, you know that there's an outstanding matter on the specifications that we had requested on public transport for people with disabilities, whether it's a bus or a taxi. And there have been problems about finances, that if you put in those specifications, then the transport owners or the manufacturers are then saying that it becomes impossible to purchase those buses or those taxis. I'm not sure where that debate is at this point in time because public transport for people with disabilities is a serious problem in this country. It has to do with them not being able to get to work and all kinds of other things. The CETA review, again, is about the capacity of the board. I think this has been coming up throughout our debates with them and engagement with them. I don't know if at NEDLEC it's something that you are really discussing. I see you've also closed on this one. But I don't think we've done much to ensure that the right people are serving those boards. I don't know if it's something that you engage in as NEDLEC. And just lastly, on the cooperative strategy, I know it's underway, but I don't know. Progress seems to be so little in that area. And we need that. I mean, if we want people to start doing getting into real projects that can alleviate poverty, we need to bring back those cooperatives. And I think we're moving with a total speed. Thank you.
Yeah. I think I was looking at this constituency, the community constituency. Also, the organization which is representing women, I still have a problem with that. I don't know if that constituency hasn't maybe think of a women representation, the organization that includes all women. Because now I know that Women's National Coalition was there for all kinds of women, all races and so forth. But I'm having a problem because we thought the Women's National Coalition was disbanded. If we can just get clarity on that again, I think we once asked this question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My apologies to Honourable Member Dreyer for jumping the gun, getting into this debate beforehand. My apologies, my humble apologies. I'm not going to comment on your comments, and I think we'll take your comments into processes, and it will inform how we approach some of the issues. But the point I'm going to make is with respect to SMMEs. I think it's not the first time that this committee ask the issue about SMMEs, the voice of SMMEs in NEDLEC. In one of the briefings, Professor Raymond Parsons was present in the meeting. And I think it was the question was raised by Madam Chair, what's happening with the SME? Now, I have limitations as the head of the institution in that if I have on the agenda SME promotion, I don't have the right to dictate to the constituencies who they should bring. My job is merely to say, we'll be discussing SME promotion. So whoever walks in from business and say, well, I'm here, I'm sent by business to talk on this topic, I don't have the authority of interrogating that person on whether or not are you from SME. So it's a difficult issue. But it's an issue that is worth raising within the network structures as a concern that was raised by the portfolio committee. Because I think you are spot on. In terms of real job creators in the economy and anywhere else, SMEs seems to be the area that will drive job creation for us. So unless we do certain things that will help promote SMEs, that's not going to help us in terms of dealing with the unemployment or job creation issue. So I agree with you. So we will take the issue up, but we've got to take it up very carefully. I will take it up as an issue that is owned by this portfolio committee because, as I was saying, I have limitations. I can't really question who they bring. When they come in, my job is that you have a mandate. If they say yes, then we engage on the issues. I think the second aspect with respect to SMEs is that government is doing something about the promotion of SMEs. As I said earlier on, the announcement by the president, the former president, that there will be 10 items that will be ring-fenced for SME procurement, that is done. But the difficulty is that in order for that to take effect, you've got to go and align the procurement policy framework. That's the thing that is taking a bit of time to get cracking, to get going. So you've got the vehicle with no driver, literally, if one may use that metaphor. The car is there, but we can't get the driver who's going to drive it. NEDLAC respects the sovereignty of Parliament, unequivocal about that. The buck stops here. It stops in Parliament when it comes to lawmaking, policy making, and so on. We respect that. We are under no illusions that we can tell Parliament not to reopen our issues. The difficulty is the language. In Parliament, when you talk parties, you talk parties as how Parliament would understand parties. So when I say parties are bound, you would literally translate it to the language that is used in Parliament. In NEDLAC, parties means business, labour, government, and community. So I think we got caught up in that. So when I say parties are bound by decisions, I don't mean parties as in Parliament. I mean parties as in NEDLAC. So sorry, my apologies for that. But Parliament, absolute final say on anything. In the 14 years that we've been around, there are only 3 instances where a NEDLAC deal was scrutinized heavily by Parliament. So our success rate in getting Parliament to stand in our corner has been great. But of course, not merely the rubber stamp. I mean, there are things that they get tweaked, but roughly, we have had great synchronized kind of way of looking at these issues. And our point of departure is that the Labour Relations Act was one first example for us. It was a deal, a package deal. So those before me who came into Parliament to table the NEDLAC deal on the Labour Relations Act, they said to Parliament, we understand that you have absolute authority to change this, but what you must understand as MPs is that it's a package deal. If you tinker with one area, that has the potential to unravel the whole deal. And they said, for an example, the concession might be found in chapter 1, but the trade-off might actually be sitting in chapter 6. So if you choose to tinker with chapter 1, you must bear in mind that you must revisit or visit that particular trade-off in chapter 6. So I think that was understood by the MPs then, because there were not many difficulties with the Labour Relations Act. I think it went through fairly smoothly in Parliament. But I concur. Parliament, hey, you can tell us that, look, back to the drawing, we can tear up a net-leg deal quite easily. You have the constitutional right to do that. So that is out of the way. Casualization, I think the jury is still out there. I mean, they are fighting net-leg about this issue. They are tensioned about this issue. And they are precisely along the lines you've been putting across, and others putting a different viewpoint on the matter. It's a difficult matter. At the first phase, when I said first phase is done, all what it meant, the parties, they said, look, perhaps what we can do, without changing the law, without changing anything, the Department of Labor must go away and look at strengthening compliance with the existing framework, and look at also the issue of what other institutions that we have that could play some role, you know, the institutions within the labor market, that could play some role to deal with this issue. This was like a first shot at it. Let's not change anything for now. Let's just go out there and see what we have and see if we can manage the issues. But we've reached a point now where that has been done, but still there is a problem. So we're moving to second phase. The second phase is where this debate, this robust debate, I mean, some people are saying casualization must be criminalized, must be banned. Looking at the Namibian example, brokers, and it's a very difficult debate. It's a very difficult debate. But now we're going to be handling it within the context of decent work, and that might bring in a bit of flexibility, because in a sense that it's an international decision, or it's an international best practice, which enjoys the support of government, labor, and business. So in that way, I mean, we're going to bank on that perhaps we might get some kind of flexibility. But of course, we need to craft something that suits our own environment as South Africans. So the jury's out there, honorable members. The task team that was assigned by the president to develop the South Africa's response, I think I tried to report on that. The task team has developed the first draft. Package. But that draft is now being taken back to principles. So government is taking it back to government, labor is taking it back to labor, business is taking it back to business, and community is taking it back to community constituencies for mandating. So it might change. Principles might change it. And there's also a view from government that they may even bounce it off cabinet at some point, just to make sure that there is what we think we are agreeing on is actually exactly what we are agreeing on. But there is a framework that is in place, fairly a credible framework. When will it be available? There are two ambitions that we had. The first ambition was that we were targeting the address by the president, the State of the Nation address by the president, which is in this week sometime. That there has to be some kind of mention of this. We're targeting that. But secondly, we're targeting the budget speech as another platform where we could do this. But the way things are at the moment, we may not meet any of those milestones because parties, they say they require more time to look at this. But I haven't received any formal response from the constituents in terms of when are they... Some constituencies are coming back to me by close of business today. Some have indicated they're coming back to me by close of business on Thursday. If all of them come back to me by close of business on Thursday, and there is enough to justify a deal, then we fly. Then we are in time for the presidential address. If by Thursday, by close of business on Thursday, I have something that's got too many holes in it, then it requires me to then reconvene the social, the task team, to see if we cannot close the gap. So we're looking at, so I can't give you a definite answer as to when, but watch the space. We're moving with some speed. Business wants, labor wants, because... Now the president is saying, yay, he wants the stuff, so we're moving with some speed there. Yes, we've given you shorthand version of some of the stuff, and I think we need to give you more stuff. And it might be useful to do that fairly quickly, maybe before you disappear, to give you some meat on some of the stuff. If needs be, we're more than happy to do that. And we could also give you a sense of what the arguments are. We seem to have only done that in casualization, because there are arguments which you need to take into account in terms of how difficult some of these issues are. So, yes, I mean, if we get recalled, that will be quite happy. Community constituency. I'm also a member of that constituency, by the way, like many of you sitting here. So it sort of pains you if that constituency, and that Madam Chair has also raised a critical point, being a woman. That as a woman, I mean, besides the fact that the community and women in the community constituency of NASA, they also came to represent you, Madam Chair, and we don't question them when they say so. Capacity in that constituency is a huge problem. But not because capacity is not there. The capacity is there. My argument is, unless you have an agenda, if the community constituency has an agenda, and the various sectors within the community constituency, they have a clear agenda of what they want from NetLab, finding capacity is not an issue, in my view. But if you don't have an agenda, capacity problems then kick in, because you get sucked into government's agenda, you get sucked into labor's agenda, you get sucked into business. So you are dealing with somebody else's agenda. And if you're dealing with somebody else's agenda, you don't have ready or standby capacity to deal with somebody else's agenda. My gripe with the community constituencies that they don't have their own agenda that they place on the table to say, this is where we are bound. Because once you have an agenda, it's almost incumbent on you to find somebody who's going to drive it. So capacity then is not an issue. Capacity becomes an issue because we're dealing with somebody else's agenda. What are we doing to build capacity in the community constituency? As I said, there are monies that we set aside for capacity, not only for community, but for community, labor, and business. I mean, the only people we don't give capacity to is government. Amalashara, we really done. Yeah, coal doesn't go back to Newcastle. So there's capacity that we, money that we set aside is for capacity. Now, the trouble is that once the money is allocated, it's like pension fund. You know, it's your money. I can't go back to constituents and say, this is how you will spend the money. We ring-fence it for business. We just tell business, we've got so much money for your capacity. How they spend it is entirely up to them. Community, here's your money. How they spend it, it's your issue. Labor, this is your money. How you don't spend it is the issue that sits in your domain. That's a difficulty. And the intervention in terms of developing a plan becomes an issue. But we have now called a meeting with the community constituency. This is the initiative of the executive director to say, firstly, how do we deal with community constituency? How do we make community constituency a force? Because with the draft rescue package, unless community comes to the party, there are key aspects of the draft package that we've developed that would not work. The expanded public works program is going to have serious difficulties. Classical example. Expanded public works program workers earn a particular amount of money. There is a minimum that they must earn, and it's by proclamation of the minister. community thing is not enough. Now, if you go ahead in the next phase or in implementing the response package for South Africa on the global crisis, and you don't change that, community workers are not, you're not going to have a take. And if we don't get community to come into the loop, there are things we can do. There are battles we're winning because community has come to the party. But if community is unhappy, there are certain things we are not. This home-based care, we want them to do some of the stuff that's done. So it has to come in. So we're discussing strategies with the community constituency on how to take those things forward. Perhaps when you call us again, we'll be able to give you a plan. And it might be useful, perhaps, at some point to have maybe a focus session with just community constituencies of NEDLAC and this committee to say, community, hey, what's up? You know, just tell us how are you approaching NEDLAC. That might be useful. On transport, public transport, the specifications is an issue that is still outstanding. It's a huge issue. Also, it is also a reflection of how effective the sector that represents people with disabilities in these discussions. When we had the session with the Minister of Transport, this issue was raised, the policy session. It was raised heavily that this is an issue that needs to be taken up, and we need, cost or no cost. But he hoed us, the Minister hoed us with an argument, which is now coming up, this bus subsidy thing. He said, well, some of the things that have cost implications, he has to be careful because there may not be resources to fund some of these things. So it's a method that is still outstanding. And it will be useful, Honourable Member, to get your constituency by default in NEDLAC to maybe to drive it. Because we lose these things. I mean, you could imagine, if business drops an issue, it will be hard for me to resurface it. I might be hit for resurfacing an issue. It has to be business that drives that particular issue. CETAs, there's corporate governance issue here. We have CETAs that are run by their boards. NEDLAC constituencies nominate people to serve on those boards. In 2007, the issue of the capacity of board members on CETAs was raised, and there was a commitment from all social partners in NEDLAC that they will second senior level people from their respective constituencies to CETAs to address that problem of capacity. The second commitment and the second initiative that is done, and the Department of Labor is very much helping to set this up, is that there are now programs that are accredited and are run by universities that seeks to build capacity of CETA board members that are tailored specifically for the work that CETAs do. People get certificated. I mean, when they go through these programs in partnership with universities, they walk away from that board with the skill that they can apply elsewhere. So capacity is being dealt with at the level of making sure that representation on the board are at the right level and that people have the capacity to come in there. Of course, there are issues about the term of office, that when somebody is just about to grasp the issues on the board, somebody else is replaced. And there are some institutions that don't want you to stay longer than necessary. And it does. So those are some of the issues that were surfaced by the review that we did. So the right people, there's a commitment that we get the right people to serve in there, and there is a commitment and actually an initiative to ensure that they get the capacity to run those boards. But as NEDLAC, we are limited in terms of how much we can tell them what to do, unless if we want to change the entire policy framework. That's different. That's an area we can play with. But if it is just administrative and operational, we must just rely on the boards to help us to do that. Women participation in NEDLAC, Women National Coalition, is the last point. Madam Chair, I can't answer this question. You put me in a fix. Because I can't get involved in constituency internal affairs. I think in the same way as CONSAU, a federation that is outside of NEDLAC at the moment, is not only knocking on the NEDLAC door is banging hard, is kicking the door to come in. But because it's arguing that Kosatu, Naftu, and Sedusa do not represent all workers. They are still workers. Solidarity, they're kicking the door, they want to come in. But there are processes that must be followed. I mean, Kosatu has taken us to the High Court because they said, look, talking to you doesn't seem to work. We're going to take this matter to court. They've taken us to court. The matter has been heard already, but the judge reserved judgment, so he's going to tell us whether we were right or wrong by keeping them out, as it were. So I can't really get involved in the National Coalition or women representation in NEDLAC. I'm aware it's not the first time that, Madam Chair, you raised the issue. I think you've raised this concern a couple of times. And I think it goes back to the point. When I call on women to come in and they bring in people and say, do you have a mandate? They say, yes. Who do you represent? They say, women. That's it for me. I can't ask any more probing questions. But it's a matter that we need to take up. Maybe it might be an issue that we take up in our discussions with the community constituency in terms of just checking the representativity of the coalitions that are represented in there. Cooperatives, there's been a bit of to-ing and fro-ing here. There was one point that we came here and said we're almost done with the strategy. I mean, coming here again, I said, hey, there's a chance that I might be charged for having lied or having misled this committee. But it's the nature of the issue. It came and it was withdrawn by the minister, because he thought it was weak in some areas. So it came in, and there was a big fanfare in Pretoria at some sports grounds where they were launching it. You may have caught a wind about it, but it got withdrawn. So it got launched publicly, then the minister pulled it back. It has now come back, as it were. So that's where we're at right now. We're looking at this renewed strategy. It's creating other problems as well. I'm not sure if I did report this, that they have now been, we've just reported some unintended consequences of the cooperative law on labor standards. That some dodgy businesses are registering their companies as co-ops, in order to sidestep the Labor Relations Act or labor standards. So we picked it up and we did some impromptu investigations on some of the companies that we identified as companies that are involved in that practice. Now, the next phase, we're moving into a possible tightening of the cooperatives law. So it could also have a bearing on the strategy, because we need to tighten those areas up. And all the parties have agreed to go and look at those areas that need to be tightened up, as it were. But that thing continues. I mean, as recent as Thursday last week, there were reports in the NEDLAC Management Committee that practice still continues. So it's critical. It's going to be even worse now with the global economic crisis, because that's going to be an easy way out, when in actual fact we want to use co-ops as a cushion to people who might be, retrenched, that we need to get companies to come and support co-ops, as it were. So if that's going to happen, it's going to create problems. Now the difficult issue about this is community constituencies, particularly the co-ops coalition, don't want anybody to tamper with the cooperative law as it stands. So there's tension. So what we then said was that we will then involve representatives from the co-ops coalition to be part of the process at a technical level, because we've employed a lawyer, an expert on the matter, that at that technical level, perhaps they should also have a lawyer. Business is going to have a lawyer, NEDLAC is going to have its lawyer, who's going to be neutral, and then community is going to have a lawyer as well in there to look at these issues. So they also wanted a lawyer, and that was approved on Thursday, that community can also come in to shape this. But there's that tension already, that we lack the existing law. Don't touch it. Labor is saying this law is messing us up, as it were. So that's where we're at in terms of the cooperatives, in the cooperatives domain. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Yeah, maybe before that, I'll come back to you. Earlier on, you said in terms of spending, you don't have a say. I don't know if you would, maybe you would also, you won't know if what is meant by this constituency expenses. I mean, in line of each constituency getting a receiving a grant, what is really meant by this constituency expenses? Maybe also for Umesh, maybe for you to have something, to respond on something. This the institution statement reflect a provision on for local travel, an amount of I think it's 50 million plus. How are the international trips funded? Mrs. Prayer and Tate Babu, the senior citizen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A comment, and also like to hear your comment on my comment, on combining two different difficult issues. The chairperson asked a question about women, the women's constituency. We couldn't answer. The other difficult issue that has been raised is casualization and the huge debate still on that. I want to combine the two, and I want to make a statement saying that we must look at, with an open mind and in a creative way, at casualization, because it might actually benefit women and other marginalized sectors of society, young people, for example. I'm just thinking in terms of a young woman who's given birth to, she's got a young baby or she's got young children at home. She needs to work, she needs an income. But she doesn't want to be at work from Monday to Friday between 8 and 5, the conventional working hours. She wants to be at home with her children, raising her children, making sure that they get the best possible, you know, preschool stimulation from herself. But finding a job after conventional hours at the supermarket all that stays open until 9 or 10 at night, you know, the one people get up and they want to go shopping and leave the shopping, that's a job for her. Or she might work as a waitress at a restaurant serving people who want to eat at 9 o'clock at night. That's a job for her. Many students also, young people who want to, you know, still studying, but they need an income, but they also need to gain some experience. That's a useful opportunity for them. While at the end of their studies, they have paid their own way through their job, a casual job, you know, working unconventional hours, and they will also have gained some experience at the same time. So that person is now better equipped to get into the formal job market. The same for the woman with her children. She's stayed in touch. She's earned a living. She could look after her children when they're old enough to go to school. She could go back to more conventional hours if that's what she wants. So casualization could be very useful to many categories of people, and we shouldn't lose sight of that.
I think that was a comment. Baba?
Yeah. I don't know how possible it is for NEDLAC to sometimes visit these places where they use casualized labor and talk to them and hear about their own personal experience and not getting from people sitting in there in the boardrooms like this or this casualization is the slavery of the 21st century, where people work 20, 30 years, they have no benefits. If she or he gets sick today, he is expelled. He dies today, he is expelled, he is not given anything. We can't speak of a democratic South Africa and at the same time practice such things as casualization. I don't care what name you need, decent or undecent, but it is slavery of the 21st century. If it was possible, I would say, sometimes you must go to this place, this big supermarket, these restaurants where you find students or young people working there
not paid. They depend on tips they get from customers who come to restaurants. But they get those jobs through these labor brokers. And they finish work at 10, 11 restaurants, and they must find their own way home. Small girls, young girls of about 18, 19, high school girls, must find their way home. I don't know how beneficial is that work is. When you saw the minister, I was saying, you must get rid of this. I agree with the minister. It needs to be got rid of. It's, maybe you are, it's not only the, it's this labor law. Is there, this schedule is there because of a, the corrupt social system this country produces. The social system that allows this type of thing to happen. Because it's this social system, not the MPs or ministers sitting in that parliament. It's the social system itself that allows this type of thing. I would suggest you must find a way of visiting these places, these supermarkets or restaurants, and talk to these people before you formulate your policy. And talk to them. Listen to what they will say to you. When will not be there, theorizing. I'm saying this because I've been to these supermarkets, talking to these workers. In restaurants, in supermarkets, in farms, I've talked to them. I know what they think, I know what they say. And not say to, and not talk to Joe, because Joe here, maybe he has got a domestic worker at home. He would prefer that cheap labor from that labor broker. But go there and talk to them. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe in addition, Mr. Dalla. I'm looking at this deficit. I know that in some teaser explained something, but my mind was not fully in bed in those finances. Maybe one would want to know the segment that reflects this substantial amount in deficit. What are the reasons for this deficit other than maybe, if it's not lack of planning and accurate projection. If I can just get a clarity, the red line here. Yeah, I would like to understand this. Thank you. Over to you,
then, thank you, Madam Chair. It sounded as if you were eavesdropping in one of the sessions we had in NetLink, because that's precisely the kind of argument that was raised on casualization, Honourable Clare. The input was titled "The Case for Casualization," and it captured almost in that order some of the arguments for casualization. So hence I'm saying maybe you were eavesdropping there when we're engaging on these issues. It's a sensitive matter, because there was a counter-argument also presented there, as it were. But it's an issue that we need to look at going forward. And it's going to be tricky. And there are extremes here. I mean, we can just see between Honorable Mjali and yourself, two extremes are already emerging. Honorable Mjali saying, ban this. It's 21st century slavery. Business is saying, that's just the way business is done in the 21st century. So it's difficult. I can't comment more than you have. I think you've captured the issues precisely the way it was tabled in NetLink. The Honorable Mjali, the Employment Conditions Commission, which is one of the institutions we had set up, one of its functions is to advise the minister on sectorial wage determinations. They have done that work that you're talking about, almost in detail. I mean, some of the stuff you're mentioning here is like you've read that research. So we've seen that research. We've seen that research from that commission, of course, via the Department of Labor. And that research is part of the engagement on the atypical forms of employment. Now, there are some horrible stories that have been reported on these matters. And maybe that's the reason why the minister is taking such a hard line. It's because he has had sight of that research, as it were. So that is done. So the information is there. We just have to find a way of how we weave that into whatever policy framework that we may merge with. So it's there. Yeah, I think the other issues were just comments, Honorable Minister. We know this. I mean, I used to be the Deputy General Secretary of SACAO, a union that operates in the retail sector. So I know some of the stuff that happens. So we have a lot of experience in hindsight and information in hindsight. But it's a difficult debate. It's extremely difficult. But we'll survive. South Africans, they survive. We'll survive. We'll find a way. We'll find a way of how to deal with it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the constituency expenses, like Herbert has explained, there's only three constituencies that get a budget from the entire NEDLAC budget. It's the community, labor, and business. Now, the purpose of this budget is for to build capacity. Two of the three constituencies hold an office at NEDLAC's premises. Usually what the constituencies use this budget for is for research. They tend to spend quite a substantial amount of their budget on research activities, and there's a small chunk of their budget which they use for administrative expenses. Like I said, they hold an office at NEDLAC, so they have an administrator who basically coordinates the activities of the constituency from the house at NEDLAC. We can't tell them what they should do with their funds. It's entirely up to them, as long as it's work-related. Now, what has happened over prior years since the inception of NEDLAC is, should the constituencies not fully utilize the budget at the end of the financial year, the surplus funds that were left over would then be transferred to a reserve. So our external auditors basically said that we are not allowed to hold over funds that actually belong to National Treasury. They should either spend it or they should give it back. And if they didn't do that, they were then going to qualify our financial statement. So what happened in this year of 2008 is the constituencies had to use their funds, which obviously exceeded our budget for the year and resulted in the deficit that we now have. So that's the issue of the constituency expenses. In terms of travel, Madam Chair, we don't usually undertake international travel. The amount that you saw is actually wrong. It's not 15, but it's 3 million. 15 million is the total expenses for the year. We do sometimes have international travel, which is usually sending a delegation to the WTO talks in Geneva, but most of that expense is usually subsidized by other government departments like the DTI. But this travel figure that you see there is all local. And that's for transporting our delegates for all the meetings that we have in Johannesburg. And most of the technical expertise of the constituencies somehow, they're usually based in Cape Town. more members in Cape Town or Durban rather than in Johannesburg. So we have to incur the cost of bringing them over. Thank you.
With your permission, Madam Chair, if I could just one point.
Yeah,
I think it's important.
I was actually looking at this, the deficit one. You explained that, but I wanted to know this 1.2. Why is it so? To me, it's a substantial amount on that deficit. I wanted to get the reasons for that, other than I said maybe it could be lack of planning or maybe the projection.
Yeah, it looks like the department wants to also help with clarification.
Is that on that, Madam Khalifa? Yeah.
I think the better way of explaining deficit is that it's not a deficit in the technical term. It's a paper deficit. It's a deficit on paper. It's not that they use money that they don't have. What they did is that, let us say you budgeted for this year that you spend 100 rand in your budget. And in your savings, you've got 200 rand that is sitting there that you have not used in the previous year. Now, you end up spending 150,000 rand by taking 50,000 rand from your savings into this previous budget. Therefore, you spent more than what you budgeted for that year, but you took money from someone else and put it there. That's why National Treasurer approved the deficit, because under normal circumstances, National Treasurer will never approve any institution that get transfer money from National Treasury to have a deficit. Therefore, the deficit that they're talking about is a paper deficit. That's how they need to account for it in terms of the paper. But in terms of the money that they use, it's not that they use money that they do not have. I think that's a lay person's explanation of that deficit for us to understand what is it.
Thank you. I'm sure we'll hear more of that tomorrow from the department, that thing of transferring of money from one section to the other. That's
just one point I wanted to make. And the point is, NEDLAC was established before PFMA came into being. Now, in the period before PFMA came into being, there was a facility where constituencies were allocated money. At the end of the year, because there was no requirement to take the money back, the constituencies kept the money in the reserve, but without taking it away from NEDLAC. But we ring-fenced them. We said this is business reserves, labor reserves, and community reserves. Then PFMA kicked in. Then PFMA said, you can't keep money. So there was an argument by labor, community, and business that, but hey, it doesn't apply to the monies we kept before PFMA kicked in. It applies from the time when PFMA kicked in. Now, at the time when PFMA kicked in, I think labor had something roughly in the order of a million kept. And they justified it in the executive council as to why they hadn't used those monies. So they left those monies now because they were before PFMA. And then every year that then followed, they use the money. But I mean, if you leave the money there, they also grow, as it were. Until the Executive Council said, those, and the Department of Labor started saying, those constituencies that have accumulated reserves in their capacity allocations must start using them, or they're going to lose that money. Treasury, they said, they're going to come and take that money away. So what then happened last year is that constituents started using those money because of an instruction from the Executive Council. They started spending those money. Now, those are the monies that they were drawing from their reserves. But in terms of our books and bookkeeping, we've got to show that as if, or in the current financial year, we've got to show that there. So we spend more, although, as Mkhalifa was saying, It's more in paper. It doesn't mean that we spend money we didn't have. We were using monies in the reserves to pay for the current activity, which was not part of the plan, but was a resolution of the Executive Council that unless you spend that money, Mr. Lescaritas was going to take the money back. They didn't want that to happen, so they started using the money. So it's an unintended consequence. You try to do a good thing, it gives rise to something else that you don't like, as it were. But if you look at the balance sheet tells a totally different story, because it tells you exactly that, look, there was money for this, and they still have more money, by the way. They haven't used up all that money in the reserves, so we're still nudging them and pushing them to use up that money. So we might end up in the 2008-2009 financial year with another deficit in terms of if they used up all the money. I think it's only business that has used up all its money. And it was a lot of money. I mean, over half a million. They're using that money and they've used it. Labor is still beckoning to use their money because it's quite a bit. But we've also told them that they've got to, by the end of this financial year, they must have used a substantial amount of money. Otherwise, the auditors are not going to be happy, as it were. So that's another explanation to this. But the department will also help to explain this further tomorrow when they appear before you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think there has been some questions here, and I think members, if you remember last time that when we were getting briefing on employment equity, there has been this thing of Employment Condition Commission to say they could come to come and brief us. But from the questions coming up from members, I think we need to, if we had time, we would really invite the Employment Condition Commission to come and explore more on some of the questions. But we'll see as time goes on. It's an unfortunate that we are nearing our end of this term, and there's nothing really that we can do, but maybe it will be on some of the proposals for the incoming members of the committee to be done. But it's an unfortunate that NEDLAC has really been getting this difficulty in getting these other departments. We think really you need a full recognition as a institution, because you're taking the institution as an important one. So it's an unfortunate for those departments that do not fully recognize you and the use of yourself. I don't think really for now we can do something, but I'm sure engaging chairpersons of those departments, it's very important for you to have that sound relationship with other departments. But thank you very much for this. I think this was, the information is really good for us, and we have more things that we didn't know or clarified before about that. So it will be a very document for us, even those who won't be serving in the committee after the elections. But this will be a very good document for us to take it with wherever we go. But thank you very much. Tomorrow's meeting, the venue will be at Committee Room 2. Because we've been having problems of this, the technicians, maybe to correct this. We don't, some rooms do not have
air condition, as you could see that some of the things are not working, but I think we won't have that problem at committee room 2. In our notices, maybe it will still reflect this thing, but please, let's go tomorrow there at 10 o'clock to meet with the department. There will be a finger lunch served. I don't know if it's there. But thank you very much for coming, Mr. Mkhaliki, and also Tina for being with us today. And Satim Chiza, thank you very much. Until we meet, maybe, I don't know when, but thank you very much. I'm sure I really, really am happy about the relationship between yourself and the committee. And we've been having this really good sound, a good relationship with yourself. Thank you very much. And the meeting is adjourned. Yeah. Lunch outside. The lunch is ready.
I'll come to this. No.